Motion to approve the minutes from February 11th? Representative Lissalgard moves the minutes from February 11th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are passed. We got a lot of bills on the calendar. Just want to remind testifiers that we're only going to be able to limit comments to just 1 or 2 minutes. And we'll take questions at the end of the bill, if at all possible, so we can keep things moving tonight. We do have a room reserved at 6:30, but we're all hoping that that won't be necessary. So if folks can keep that in mind, that would be appreciated. And with that, the first bill on the agenda is House File 3268. Representative Purcell, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I would like to move House File 3268.
I believe it's on its way to government operations next. So Representative Purcell moves House File 3268 be referred to GovOps. Chair Purcell, if you could go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We need to start out. Everybody does. This is quite a nice, simple bill. I think this one is actual. What I'm trying to do here with this bill is for us as legislators and for our public to begin to get our heads around this perfluoral chemical substances issue. And I think most of you, not all of you, know that we've got that up in Bemidji, Minnesota, and drinking water wells and the typical pathway of firefighter foam being used, unbeknownst to the firefighters. And I've got a son that's a volunteer firefighter, so this comes pretty close to home, they've been using these chemicals for a long time. Wanting to create this task force to look at contamination, groundwater contamination. We know there's a lot of potential pathways, and what we don't know is really the extent and scope of perfluorochemicals in our environment. And I think we really need to get a handle on that. I tell you the analogy that I have with this, and I'm flashing back here, is Agent Orange. I feel just like we're right back there dealing with Agent Orange after Vietnam. In that case, it's dioxin that's in those organochlorine pesticides, and ended up dioxins everywhere. It's in your grocery stores. Well, what about this here? I don't know. I don't have the answer, but we need to have some opportunity to get information in front of us so we can answer some of those questions about nature and extent. And I'm not going to read through the whole bill, but I'm going to stop there. And I know we got a lot of things to do today, and entertain questions.
And we do have one testifier lined up ahead of time, and that's Greta Gauthier from the MPCA. Ms. Gauthier, if you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in House File 3268. This bill sets up a PFAS task force, sets up PFAS reduction goals and reporting requirements for my agency, and we very much appreciate having the appropriation for a staff person to help with this work. PFAS is going to be, as Chair Purcell said, a very, very big issue in the 21st century. This was really brought home to me recently when I was working on a proposal for LCCMR that we have in right now on PFAS. And one of our bright young engineers who's working on this, after a long discussion about the proposal and the issues, just kind of looked up at me and said, "I'm going to be working on PFAS for my entire career." And I said, "Yeah, you are." And that's kind of, hit home for me about what a big issue PFAS is going to be. By the way, that LCCMR proposal is very, very important to the agency and our work on addressing PFAS. It's only partially funded right now, and we would hope that it can be fully funded in the final LCCMR recommendations. So we agree with the intent of this bill and the direction it's heading. Last year, PCA Commissioner Laura Bishop set up an agency-wide internal cross-cutting team to look at PFAS, and we call it our PFAS lateral team. Our initial goal was to look inside our agency, but we are also going to reach out, and other agencies want to get engaged in this as well. What we did first was look at areas, where are we already working on PFAS and what are we doing, and then identifying gaps so that we can fill in knowledge, data that we need to move forward. As I mentioned earlier, the LCCMR project is like the top key gap that we need funded in order to continue. It's not an end-all be-all, but it's a critical piece. So this group is working on how do we understand how to approach and address PFAS. So what don't we know about it yet? There's still things we don't know. Does it result in certain industries or areas of the state or practices more so than others? Where is the PFAS contamination located statewide? Things like that. And while we continue to work with this group, it is now being brought in to include DNR and health and agriculture. So it is in line and picks up the same thread as this bill does. This bill creates a task force with a broader membership, which we also think is a great idea. And working forward in our lateral team, that's something that we were hoping to do as well. So we support the intent of the bill. We definitely agree that a broad statewide discussion is needed on PFAS because it's going to take a lot of work from a lot of different sectors in order to address it. But because this bill includes a supplemental appropriation, agencies are not taking positions on bills with supplemental appropriations until after the governor's supplemental budget is presented to the legislature next month. So we are not taking a formal position on the bill at this time. And I'm happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. Any questions for Ms. Gauthier while we have her up here? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe, I don't know if this is appropriate for Ms. Gauthier, maybe the bill author. Do we have any idea on how frequently this group would meet? And I see we've named basically all the commissioners. A little discussion about I can't foresee the commissioners sitting in a room once a month on this type of thing. How will that responsibilities be delegated within the agencies to participate in that committee?
Ms. Gauthier, and I'll remind folks too, this is going to GovOps after this, so Ms. Gauthier.
Madam Chair and Representative Lewick, thank you for the question. I don't recall reading about a requirement for frequency of meetings in the bill, so I'm assuming that were this bill passed into law, that would be left up to the agency to determine. I can certainly ask the commissioner what she would think in a hypothetical situation, but I'm sure we would address that.
Chair Purcell.
And thank you, and Representative Lewick and committee. My understanding is, and I'm going to go back again to the Agent Orange analogy, we don't know enough about this. We know it's bad news, and at significantly low levels, as was dioxin, is dioxin. So I would offer to you, it's premature to have an understanding yet of, I think we're going to have to get the information together statewide and understand all of the potential pathways.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you. Understand, and I guess there is a, you know, there's a report due there, so that would drive, you know, some level of what activities is needed. But I'll, in the interest of time here, I'll just.
Madam Chair, I would.
Chair Purcell.
I would just offer the report may say we need more time. It wouldn't surprise me a bit. I would hope we could understand it quicker, but from my experience up in the Bemidji drinking water, I mean, this thing, and it's so litigious that we don't know where it's going to go fully.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple of questions, because in reading the bill, and I apologize, I did read through it in my office yesterday, but didn't really delve into it much. But you've got some benchmarks set here to reduce the PFAS by 50%, and then by 2026, and 90% by 2030. But it looks like more information continues to come in. Is there a floor? I mean, how are you going to gauge the 50%? And if we don't know all that's in there, I don't even know how that's possible to say you can. So can you explain that?
Ms. Dothier. Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, thanks for your question. Right, as of right now, we do not have a floor on PFAS contamination statewide of groundwater and surface water. That's one of the components that would need to fall into place in order for us to measure after we take steps or treatments or whatever is out there, which we need to analyze and figure out what are the best treatments out there and how can we do that. We would need a floor in order to gauge whether or not we're making progress. So I don't, in terms of the goal, I think that it would take quite a bit of work to get that established under those timeframes, and we're happy to work with the author on that and ways that we might be able to achieve some kind of goal like that in that timeframe.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. The other one is maybe a little bit more vague to me, because there's also 50% by 2024 for public awareness. I'm not really sure if I understand that. That would be in starting at 3.3 to 3.7.
Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Green, I'll tell you what I believe that means, and let Commissioner Gauthier go at it too. But the effort to increase awareness so that we can avoid the health issues that are associated, that's the intent. And not many folks know what all the exposure routes are at this point. I mean, I'm not gonna start naming them, because there's more than just water, obviously. That's the intent. I just increase awareness.
Okay. Representative Green.
Well, thank you. Then I guess the only question, it doesn't even have to be answered, but what in my mind is, you know, how would you ever gauge if you reached the 50% when you don't also on that? Where do you start, and how do you know you're halfway there? And it's only only 4 short years, and I'm sure Representative Purcell can tell you around here 4 years goes by very fast. So it's just a couple of I don't know if I'd call them concerns, but things that are not really clear.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, we'll take that as a challenge to see if we can't clarify that and do our best.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Purcell, I'm curious, and maybe staff can help out here. On line 2.4, says the task force is governed by Section 15.059, Subdivision 6. Can you give me a general outline of what that is? Ms. Taylor. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, this is some standard language that was actually suggested by the staff of the Government Operations Committee. It just specifies the typical terms for a task force, like how long they serve, how they can be removed, et cetera.
Okay.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Representative Purcell, Chair Purcell, on the first page from 1.10 through the second page, you're naming the makeup of the task force. I'm curious if anybody else has approached you with a desire to maybe be included. So my question for you is are you open to amending your bill so that if there are other entities that would like to be included in the task force, you would be willing to include them?
Chair Purcell.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have anyone else from the audience who wishes to testify on this bill, House File 3268? Members, any further discussion?
All that, with that, Chair Purcell renews his motion to refer House File 3268 to Government Operations. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, the motion carries. The next bill on our agenda, thank you, Chair Purcell. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3239, Representative Eklund. I will move that House File 3239 be referred to the General Register. Representative Eklund, if you could go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Purcell. For so.
Keep calling my name.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is a fairly simple bill to tighten up statute. What it does is make sure that any imported survey or carcasses cannot be imported into the state of Minnesota. Currently, you cannot import harvested wild game survey carcasses, and this tightens up loophole for something that for carcasses that could come from game farms or other type situations. And I have the DNR to talk about the technical questions of this, and with that I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, members, Representative Eklund, I mean, this is fairly simple. There is a loophole. The current law says hunter-harvested carcasses cannot be imported. There are instances where people can import a carcass that was shot through, that was taken, I guess, through a high-fenced hunting area, so on a game farm from another state, or if they just purchase an animal from another state that technically isn't hunter harvested. So this is just closing that loophole, and I can stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Colonel Smith, you say there's a loophole, and you say that they can do this. Are there instances where they have done this? What problem are we trying to solve that's occurred?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we've had a few instances where people are importing these carcasses. Normally it's very difficult to catch them in transit because obviously you need probable cause. We don't have officers sitting at the border on 94 in Wisconsin waiting to look at every vehicle that drives through. We do catch some through some of the compliance checks that we do with commercial processors. We have had run across instances where there have been carcasses, whole carcasses from other states, hunter harvested, and then sometimes you get into that question of, okay, did they harvest that hunter harvested, or did they get that from shooting it from a game farm? And so we don't see this as a major issue, but it is a loophole, and we want to be able to close that so that there's no question that, and it's very simple, any carcass that comes into the state, or you can't bring any carcass into the state no matter how you acquire it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's reasonable to assume, Representative Eklund, that this is a result basically of CWD. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, yes.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, and I noticed that, you know, there's the effective date is following final enactment, and I understand that, and not that I don't not support this, but at some point in the future when we hopefully have CWD under control, are we going to have to pass a law to repeal this if, you know, 20 years, 50 years from now, obviously?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that would be great if we could do that. But I think until we get the CWD thing figured out, this is one of the options we have to take.
Thank you.
Representative Beckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to point out that the restrictions on movement of carcasses are folks who are going to hunt in other states already who are actually, you know, licensed hunters are already under these restrictions, so this would just kind of level the playing field and make sure folks who are acquiring deer through other means are under the same sort of restrictions. So I know that, you know, I've talked to folks in the hunting community, and it is sort of a burden that people are under, but I think most folks are willing to do that to make sure we're addressing CWD. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess a question I have is, will this have implications on harvested cervidae that are used for food purposes within Minnesota? That's a actual small but legitimate industry out there. How is this going to, is this going to have an impact on the ability to move that type of product around within the state?
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Lewick, I don't believe it will. I think they'd be under the same restrictions that they are now. Any cervidae that is died or killed on game farms needs to be tested for CWD right now, and so I don't believe it would be under the same protocols.
Representative Lewick.
I would caution there that when I said meat product, I did not specifically say game farm, so there's a difference, big difference, and it relates maybe a little more to elk, but there's a large amount there. Those animals are also raised purely for meat, nothing to do with a game farm. So, and I guess that would fall upon the DNR to make sure that we don't get snagged into, you know, some new judicial. Is this going to go to judicial at some point for them to sort out? I mean, just need to be cautious here that we don't unintentionally disrupt something that is probably not a problem.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewick, I think if you look on line 1.9, it says, except for cut, wrapped meat quarters or other portions of meat with no spinal column or head attached. So I think that might address what your concern is, but I appreciate the comment.
Representative Hampton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Lewick, if you look on line 1.12, it's from originating outside of Minnesota. So it's any of these that are coming in from who knows where. So the domestic production is not affected. It's the importation that's being affected.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to be clear on, and not because I'm opposed to what we're doing, but I just want to be clear on what we're doing here. So we're banning non-hunter harvest, all carcasses coming into the state. For Colonel Smith, does DNR have any plans to ban the transfer of harvested by any means carcasses within the state of Minnesota? So if you're in one of those four areas that we saw yesterday in Chair Hansen's committee, are you proposing considering banning the removal of deer from those areas? So say that I go to hunt in Crow Wing County and I go down from Roseau and then take that carcass back to Roseau. Is that something that you're considering?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, my understanding under the current regulations in the Southeast, you cannot remove a carcass in that endemic area until it has been cleared. I personally have not been involved in any conversations outside of those areas about restricting movement of carcasses, but that would be something that our wildlife folks would probably be able to speak better to, since they're the one that are managing CWD and the deer population.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further comments or questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beckerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to clarify that that we control whether deer are tested within the state of Minnesota. And one of these issues is that we can't control what other states are doing and what their protocols are and what their testing protocols are. So it's a good bill that'll
help make sure we got all our bases covered.
Anybody in the audience looking to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, no further comments. I'll renew the motion that House File 3239 be passed and be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Fisher isn't here at the moment, so we'll move on to House File 2992. It's an O'Neill bill. Representative O'Neill. Thank you for being here, and I'll move that House File 2992 be referred to, approved and referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance at the request of Chair Hansen. Oh, Representative O'Neill, welcome. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a little strange being in this committee. I've never brought a bill here before. I feel like I should bring treats or something.
you're moving on up, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a situation in my district that brought this to my attention, and I'm going to let my district folks talk to that, but let me just tell you quickly what this bill does. This bill basically says that if you have a solid waste disposal facility and you have reached your 1.5% of remaining design capacity, that you need to start a process with MPCA to orderly close that facility. Now, you can use that capacity. You can use the remaining 1.5% capacity. But in the next 24 months, work towards closing that facility. And there's also an opportunity for MPCA and the commissioner to extend that deadline if need be. And so there is some flexibility there for the agency. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier so that we will be brief and stay within our time limit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Derek Vetch, Wright County Commissioner. Mr. Chair, committee members, House File 2992 addresses a case of a non-conforming landfill that has virtually stopped operating over the past 6 years by taking little to no waste. When this landfill was permitted in 2010, it was assumed it would be at capacity in 5 years. Never did anyone expect a landfill that has capacity to stop taking waste to avoid final closure. This bill seeks to close this loophole and have a landfill that has minimal amount of capacity reach final closure and bring finality to the community. This landfill historically accepted over 100,000 cubic yards of waste. In 2014, they dramatically lowered their acceptance rate and have continued to lower this acceptance rate. We included a graph kind of showing the decline of acceptance rate. Basically, in 2009, accepting around 400,000 cubic yards to the current couple of years, right around 5,000 cubic yards over the last couple of years. This landfill, under its historical acceptance rates, could reach its capacity within 4 to 6 months, bringing it to closure. They have instead dragged this out over 6 years. We are asking that you provide the MPCA with the tools to help them bring finality to our community.
And Mr. Chair, we have a couple other testifiers from the community.
Very good. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Peterson. I live at 6071 County Road 12 North, Buffalo, Minnesota. right across the street from Advanced Disposal's operation. We've owned the farm for several years. We purchased it in 1969. I've been an active member in the community, which includes being on the Planning Commission for a number of years, 15 plus years, I think. And while on the Planning Commission, I witnessed the development of the current land use plan. It was developed locally with the people participating, and it is definitely the people's plan, and it was approved by the county commissioners in 2009. The Advanced Disposal is located in Monticello Township, Wright County. The township has no industrial land zoned in the township. The landfill has been operating on agricultural zone land since 2009, when the current land use plan was adopted. Twice in the past several years, Advance has applied to change the zoning from agricultural to industrial. And this was done with the intent that this would give them an opportunity to expand the landfill. In both cases, the application was withdrawn prior to the final vote by the county commissioners. And this was done because they knew that the application would fail. So where are we on the landfill today? There's very little activity out there being used. It's being, we are told that it's being used for internal use only. In fact, they have a separation plan of St. Cloud up in that area, and they bring the food waste down there, which qualifies as an industrial waste and goes into the landfill. No private construction debris is permitted in the landfill at this time. People of Wright County, Monticello Township, and the surrounding area have lived with this landfill for over 40 years. They are now being told it is off limits for their use. It is time to close this landfill. I'd like to say one more thing. I'd like to say that it's our understanding that the land use plan was developed and assessed by local representatives. And we need to support Representative O'Neill on HF 2992 and support these elected officials. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony.
I have one more testifier, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Mark Rise. I moved to Wright County in 1989. I live 1 mile from the Rolling Hills landfill as the crow flies. I can see the waste pile from my window rising above the tree line to twice the height of the local treetops. Since moving to Wright County, as you've heard, that I found it necessary to repeatedly join with my neighbors to argue and advocate on behalf of maintaining our rural way of life. The Rolling Hills landfill was foisted upon our community through legal action. This action was pursued following denial of the county of the requested expansion of the original considerably smaller landfill. As you've heard, in the last 2 years, two subsequent requests for expansions have been denied by the county in response to community opposition. Obviously, the purpose of operating a business is to generate income. If a business owner deliberately avoids income by restricting operations, we should suspect ulterior motives. I believe that is the case in this instance. Despite being turned down twice already, the owners of Rolling Hills Landfill intend to keep it open in order to take advantage of loopholes in waste management regulations. I believe they will try yet a third time to bully the citizens of Wright County into granting them a new landfill. While I've lived in my home, three different waste management companies have owned the Rolling Hill facilities. The fact that all three owners have pursued legal and don't take no for an answer bullying tactics tells me that this is a standard practice of the waste management business industry. if it's a standard practice to bully, engage in legal intimidation, and exploit any regulatory loopholes to overpower neighborhood opposition in order to get their way, we can assume that this will continue. Advanced Disposal, the current owner, is projected to be absorbed by acquisition sometime in this first quarter into Waste Management Corporation. They are the largest waste hauling company in the country. Irrespective of who owns Rolling Hills Landfill, I expect these bullying tactics to continue. That is why this proposed legislation is important to the community members of Wright County. No matter how the approval to operate Rolling Hills Landfill was achieved, the owners proposed an operation based on plans and processes that were submitted to government bodies that involved in the approval and oversight of landfills. We should expect those plans to be followed. Those plans did not include halting operations of the landfill in order to maintain an open status. To artificially maintain an open status only adds to the burden on state and county resources engaged in oversight of the landfill operation. It also adds to the burden on the quality of life and detracts from the quality of life of the community members. I'm respectfully asking you to give careful consideration to the proposed legislation, HF 2992. This legislation simply requires landfills which are full to be closed. It would prevent operators from arbitrarily maintaining them in an open status, whatever their reason for doing so. Members of the community would be in a much better position to rely on the projected closure dates and plan their lives accordingly. I thank you for the opportunity to share my observations, and I urge you to give careful consideration to this House bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Wagenius.
I'm trying to understand this. Your first testifier said this was a non-conforming landfill. Can you help us out with what that means?
The land use for this property is zoned agriculture. Landfills are in industrial land, so it is a non-conforming land use, or non-conforming landfill, okay.
I thought that's what you may be getting at. Is it a lined landfill?
Is it a large landfill?
Lined.
Lined. There's an old portion that has been there for decades that is unlined, but the newer portion that they were able to acquire through litigation is lined.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Wagenius, for asking that question. So the original landfill that was put in is not lined. And actually, there was a pollution problem, which also is very weighing on my constituents. I have additional constituents in the audience, and this is a very big deal for those that live around it, because the pollution plume now extends not only under the landfill, but it goes underneath private property. So they cannot drill wells and so on like that. With this beautiful, pristine piece of property next to them. And unfortunately, the family that owns that were not able to be here because they're in Florida, but they are adamant that they would like some relief and they would like some finality and they would like this landfill to finally close so they can continue with their lives. And that's why I've taken this step to bring the bill. Thank you for your question.
Let me ask one first, please.
So,
Representative O'Neill, do I understand then? I just heard you say there's a plume, so we've got groundwater contamination underneath this landfill. That's
yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Ginia.
So, if I have a sense of your district, it is fairly sandy because it's close to the river. Am I right about that?
Representative O'Neill. Mr. Chair, so we actually have MPCA here who can give you all of that information because there are some hydrology concerns, but I'm not an expert in that. But I'm sure that the agency would love to speak to that, and I know they were going to testify in support of this bill as well. And I do want to say, well, I have a moment while she's coming down. I had an amendment, but it has some issues, and so I'm trying to work through some of the language, and I understand that this has a path to another committee. So if I could indulge you to set aside that amendment for now and let me work on it and work with stakeholders to get it closer to where we intended, and then we can bring that up in the next committee hearing.
That's my understanding. And do you have a comment, please, Representative?
Oh, or
If we want to hear from the PCA first, that's
okay
with me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Stephen Giddings. I'm a manager at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and welcome the opportunity to testify in front of you today. With regards to the bill, you hear about the talk about a loophole. In effect, these landfills have to close pursuant to rules within 30 days of receiving the last shipment of waste or reaching final permitted waste elevations. In this situation, the landfill is not meeting those requirements, so they do not have to close pursuant to the rules. Thus, the loophole that's been referred to going forward. You've also heard, too, generally, this is not an issue. Usually, the landfills are continuing to accept waste because of the revenue that's associated with that waste. In this situation, that's not occurring. The thing about the bill, it allows 24 months in order for the landfill to get the necessary waste in order to come up the appropriate elevation to make the facility more environmentally protective. The last thing you want with a closed landfill is to have low areas where water's collecting and things such as that. So it allows that time in order for the landfill to specifically be built up so they can be properly covered and capped. The reason we feel that this is important is, again, once a facility is properly capped, you are not getting infiltration of water through the waste and the creation of leachate. When you have leachate in a landfill, it has to be managed. So there's always potential environmental issues if, in fact, that leachate is not managed properly or if there's a leak or something along that line. So when it comes to closing a landfill, again, as soon as that can be closed and capped off, the better off we're going to be environmentally in the long term. As was mentioned by Representative O'Neill, there are specific language in there that allows for continued operation and expansion if, in fact, it goes through their proper procedures and that's taken care of. But again, environmentally, if in fact they're intending on closing, the best thing that can be done is to have that closed and capped as soon as possible, again, to prevent the generation of leachate. There was a mention about groundwater contamination at the site. Addressing that, there's been a lot of investigation work that has been done out at the landfill. The landfill was originally permitted back in 1971. So it's been around for a long time. Originally, it was a municipal solid waste landfill, so it was accepting everyday garbage. The original cells of that were not lined. They continue to accept MSW material. Some of those MSW cells are lined. All of the industrial cells are lined. So more than likely, when we're seeing groundwater contamination, it's more than likely from the unlined MSW cells. So the contamination that's being looked at is vinyl chloride. VOCs from the waste may migrate through the groundwater. There's been, again, multiple wells there. We've been working to try to define the extent of the contamination, which we've been able to outline. So we have, in fact, done that. We've been working with the company on doing this, and the company's been doing a good job with it. So we've been satisfied with their investigation work to date. So we have looked into those issues. We have, in fact, defined what the extent of that contamination is.
I've got a question here real quick. And to Mr. Giddings?
Giddings, that's correct.
Giddings, okay. So the part of the landfill that you're going to allow more waste to be added to is lined at this time.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And are there monitor wells that confirm that liner is intact?
Mr. Chair, there are monitoring wells surrounding the landfill that is looking for exactly that. That's correct. We have no reason to believe that the liner itself is leaking. More than likely what we're seeing is the unlined portion contributing to potential groundwater issues.
And one final question, is there opportunity to cap, to finish, instead of bringing in waste, is there opportunity to bring in clean fill and and build up the elevation so that you can cap it.
Mr. Chair, that is an option. It's something that would be extremely expensive for a landfill to do, to get that amount of material, that amount of fill to come in. It's not a standard practice in the industry for that reason.
Understood. I deal with one of these up on Leech Lake Reservation, and the liners aren't forever. That's my concern. So 100 years from now, our grandkids are going to be dealing with it. So,
Mr. Chair, the cap is the important part, to minimize infiltration. So,
and there is a part that's not capped, that's not capped and not lined, eh? Yeah. So anyway,
Mr. Chair, just a clarification on that. The MSW landfill that was unlined is now capped. That part portion has been closed.
Thank you. Representative Wagenia.
Just one final follow-up question. Is the financial assurance required up to date?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it is.
And what is the amount?
Oh. Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have that amount here, but it's something I could get to you. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Neill, you'd mentioned that you had an amendment, but we don't have that here. And we've been given instruction that bills aren't supposed to move out of committee until they've got things worked out. So I would ask that you, Mr. Chair, that you keep this bill in the committee to get that amendment worked out. If it's a policy amendment, if it's a financial amendment, then we could consider that in my committee when it's going there. But if it's a policy amendment, I'd ask that we lay this over, continue to work on it, and then bring that up when you've got it worked out, if that's possible. I'd move to lay this bill over.
Yep. Very good. We've got a motion on the table there, and Representative Hanson moved to lay this bill on the table and until we get it finished up with the amendment that has been brought up. So,
Mr. Chair, you don't need to.
All right, then.
Not correct.
The bill's laid on the table. We'll bring it. Please bring it back with it. I was advised there was an amendment and then don't have one, so there is some confusion there. Sorry. Representative O'Neill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment just isn't, it's not perfect. And I like things to be perfect so that we have clarity. And I just felt that the amendment that was drafted had some issues. I didn't want that to continue that way. So instead of introducing one that I knew wasn't perfect, I made a commitment with the stakeholders to continue to work on it. And so we come to an agreement. And I would be more than happy to bring that once it's ready. And if you would be kind enough to give me a second hearing to bring that amendment and to finalize that, that would be incredibly appreciative.
We'll do our best to accommodate that. And I have a I left a couple folks off here, moved pretty fast, but that had comments, and I hope I'm in order that we can, and I've got another testifier, but let me proceed here with the comments, questions as it were. Representative Luke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think at this point, until we see that amendment, we probably just got to, move this right along, and we'll get another chance to deal with it. So we've got it all out on the table.
Representative Fabian?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, and I do have a testifier here that will might as well hear the testimony. I think the gentleman's here, Mr. Carnival.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to continue to work with the author and provide testimony at that point.
Very good, thank you. Okay. The bill's laid on the table, and we'll look forward to seeing you again, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. I'm very appreciative.
I don't need the amendment coming up in that room. It would be all of your eyebrows.
Next, we have House File 2999, mm-hmm. A Fisher bill.
It's typecast,
right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please Tell us about your bill. I'm going to move that the House File 2999 be referred to public safety, passed and referred to public safety and criminal justice reform, finance, and policy division.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 299. First of all, we're all concerned, all of us share the concern of protecting our natural resources here in the state of Minnesota. And we hold them in high value. And one of the things that always disturbs us is when those resources are not treated with the care and respect that they're due. And this bill tries to address some of that situation. We have this bill will address violations where game is taken that has a value of over $2,000. This means this bill would only apply to the worst of the worst poachers in the state of Minnesota. The average person could not mistakenly violate the fish and game laws that approach this level. To reach this level of restitution, somebody would need to illegally take 400 crappies, 66 walleyes, 40 ducks, 5 bears, 5 wild turkeys, or 4 deer or 2 trophy deer over the limit. So we're talking about a situation where we're grossly over the limits. People convicted of the fishing and game crimes with restitution of $2,000 or higher will have a clear intention of violating the laws. I mean, to get to that limit, you know you're past it. One of the things I do have is I do have Colonel Smith from the DNR to talk a little about the history of where we've been and what's gotten to us here today. And so at this point, I'd like to turn it over to him, if that's all right with the committee.
Very good. Colonel Smith.
Again, for the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair and members, first of all, thank you, Representative Fisher, for bringing this forward. This concept of felony violation for violating game and fish law was first brought to the legislature back in 2015 with a much larger packet. There wasn't any action taken. It came back in 2016, and the felony provision of that packet was removed. And at that time, there were some stiffer revocations that were put in place. So somebody who violates the game and fish law restitution value over $2,000 would have had a 10-year revocation of their licenses. That was increased from 5 years. So there has been some history with this provision of something becoming a felony, and it was partly addressed back in 2016. Just to clarify how somebody would have to get to 400 crappies or 66 walleyes or 40 ducks and what the restitution value is for those members that might not be familiar with it is, by statute, the commissioner and through rules has assigned a value to every animal, every wild animal in the state. And so, for example, a crappie or a sunfish, that's a $5 for one of those. A deer is $500. A trophy deer, meaning that if you measure their antlers and it gets over a certain size, that is double, so that would be $1,000. Bears are $400. Turkeys are $400. So every animal has a restitution value that once a person is convicted, they would have to pay that restitution value back to the state, and those funds go into the Game and Fish Fund. So several years ago, back in the early 2000s, when gross over limits was first put in place, these thresholds are all based on license revocation is all based on that dollar amount for the restitution value of those animals. And so when Representative Fisher says that somebody who would have to reach that felony level, it is very clear that they would have to have some intent. You don't accidentally take 66 walleyes over your limit. You don't accidentally take 400 crappies over your limit. You don't accidentally shoot 4 deer over your limit. So this would still address the worst for the worst. And with that, I can stand for questions.
Very good. Representative Luke.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the first questions I guess I have for the bill author, have you consulted with the, particularly the rural county attorneys and discussed with them the ramifications of adding a whole new class of violations that would get into felony prosecution, and the costs associated with that, the time? Is this could add a whole new workload to county attorneys that are trying to protect the citizens directly up there with limited resources.
And Representative Fisher, and you're going to public safety, so you're going to
right.
No. Prepared for this probably.
Right. No, thank you for the question. No, I've not reached out to the rural county attorneys at this point in time. The only people I've heard back for or have touched base with me and this may end up causing this bill to be laid over is there's a amendment that some of the trappers are concerned about. The way the bill is written right now is it could inadvertently cover people who've got pelts that they'd legally picked up before and are transporting them. So that is an amendment that we're working on. I apologize, we didn't have it ready. There was some, it came to us late yesterday. We weren't able to make deadline. We're still proofing it back and forth to make sure we have agreement. So I just want to put that up there that we do know there's an issue out there and that we are working on it with the trappers to make sure we're addressing their concerns.
Yes. Mr. Chair, well, then I guess that maybe would justify laying this bill down right now.
Yeah.
If there's an amendment that has to do with policy, why would you need to go any further with it till we see the amendment? Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels here.
Kind of feels like that today.
Yep. I'm fine with coming back for, and I apologize to the committee. It came up late yesterday and just had no way of making deadline, but I wanted to be transparent with everybody and let them know here's what we're hearing, and I just want to let people know that as concerns come up with any bill I work on, I want to make sure that we're taking those in and getting them incorporated to get the best product possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that I think would be helpful just so we kind of know what we're dealing with and I think would be relevant regardless of how the bill might be amended. How many people, Colonel Smith, do we know, you know, from, you know, gross misdemeanor prosecutions would fall into this as far as, you know, the last year, couple years, as far as who is fitting that category of going that far over the limit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, we tried looking at that yesterday and we came up with probably three people in the last 5 years might hit this threshold. It's not common.
Thank you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to that point, maybe the bill author could explain what problem we're trying to fix.
Fisher. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Heintzman. I would say that, well, we've got three people out there right now that we know that's happened in the past, and I think when you have something that is passing a felony threshold that we should be treating people the same across. I know that in the regular system that if you're doing damage or a felony is at $1,000. So, you know, we're, I think, being a little liberal saying we're allowing a level of $2,000 of damage to the state and before you get to that felony level.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
And that would be, I think, more kind of in the public safety range.
I agree with you, Representative Fisher. It is getting to be in a different sort of an issue. But at the same time, if in the last 5 years we've had, as testimony mentioned, three of these that have risen to this level, I mean, I think we would agree that the penalty is there to deter someone from breaking the law, right? So if we have examples of this occurring on a frequent basis around the state, well, then maybe it's something to look at. But if we have three instances in the last 5 years, what problem are we trying to fix? That's the question. And then two for Colonel Rodman, or Colonel Smith, if you could explain the scenarios where someone may accidentally break this law, and I'm sure judges and others would look at this or county attorneys and make a determination, but I have had examples in Crow Wing where a lot of people are coming up to say grandma and grandpa's house and they plan on having a fish fry or they plan on some other family activity and their freezer is technically over those individuals' limits unless they have all kinds of documentation in place. So theoretically, the scenario where someone has too many walleyes or may exceed this potential limit, I mean, that does exist, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, in rare instances, I mean, the dollar amount of $2,000 and the number of fish, we do have those on occasion where, especially when it comes to fish, where people have, I guess for lack of a better term, family limits, and which is not right. I mean, just because you have a cabin doesn't mean that
everybody in your extended family is allowed to have a limit there. And so, and normally those limits and those family limits, I guess that I'll coin the phrase here today, they're not packaged for each individual person. They just figure, well, we have 20 people that come up here, so we'll keep, you know, 20 limits worth of fish. That's pretty rare. I mean, 400 crappies in a freezer, that's a lot of fish. 66 walleyes, that's a lot of fish. And so has it happened? Probably in the last couple of years, but it's not very common.
I've got a couple more questions here. And Representative Lewis, I did hear your suggestion. And
yeah,
and
my suggestion is if there's an issue here with an amendment, we've got a set of precedents here where we're probably spinning our wheels here and leave this thing lay it right now.
I'd like to give folks a chance to just say a couple things, and then I do plan to lay it on the table. Representative Hansen.
I was going to move it to lay it on the table.
Well, just real quickly, Mr. Chair, and thank you. So, Representative Fisher, you said that that some felonies are at a $1,000 threshold. My sense is that that is a pretty hard number. I think you can make the case to a certain degree that the numbers used in restitution is somewhat subjective, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, so the restitution dollar amounts have been in rule for a long time, and there was a study done by some folks from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service years ago, and they published these recommendations. And Minnesota's pretty much stuck to those recommendations. There are other states that have deviated from them. For example, you go to Iowa, a trophy buck in Iowa could have a restitution value of up to $25,000. And so we've kept ours at $500. So to answer your question, yes and no. I mean, it depends on the science and how they made those determinations back in the day. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And Colonel Smith, you said that, I think you said that there would have been roughly three of these types of violations in the past 5 years. Were those people who were doing that, were they repeat offenders in any way in terms of, did they have other criminal record, other records, you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I'm not sure what their background. I do know that they were mostly surrounding over a limit of taking of either deer or bear. And they had other issues.
So, Mr. Chair, with regards to other issues, is it not within your statutory authority to actually charge those if they have previous records as a felony? Can't you do that already?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, yes, depending on what kind of other issues there are, when we work closely with our county partners and city police, depending on where the person is or where the crimes happen, but normally when we go forward with a charging document of this size, if it's a gross misdemeanor, we'll do what's called a long form complaint. We just don't write a ticket. And so we'll consult with the county attorney and bring everything together. And so, yes, to answer your question the long way, yes, those other things will be addressed through a formal complaint. But a lot of times that's done in conjunction with the county sheriff or local police department.
So, Mr. Chair, they already have the flexibility. I'm really at a loss for why we're doing this bill. And granted, we are laying it over, and I appreciate that. So let's move on.
Thank you. And that, with that, I'm going to lay this bill on the table, and we'll see it again. So, thank you, Representative Page.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
So, without further bills to hear or commentary, we're going to stand adjourned. Thank you.